This is a production of Cornell University.
Good afternoon, everybody. We're going to get started by taking your seats. For those who are just coming in, feel free to grab refreshments at the table. The time is 4:30. We do have a quorum, so I'm calling this meeting of the University Assembly to order. First up on our agenda is a call for late additions. Do any members have anything they'd like to add to our agenda as a late addition? Hearing none, I'd like to actually go out of order on our agenda and turn the floor over to Alan Mittman, Carol Grembach, and John Celentano from the University's representing the University Administration concerning Policy 6.4, since there's no dissent. Hearing none, Mr. Mittman, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the invitation. This is the first of four roadshows that are happening in the next little while, and so some of you will be seeing this twice, but the collective judgment and interaction is what matters, so please, at the end, feed us questions and things like that. So we're here to update everybody on the status of Policy 6.4 and its the revisions that are being contemplated after a long set of considerations and meetings. We're finally ready to propose some aspects. It's under construction right now, but we want to give these groups an opportunity to weigh in along the way. So, by the way, on my page, the cloud is more typical-like, it's much more storm-like. You can't actually read the white lettering, Policy 6.4, prohibited discrimination, protected status harassment, sexual harassment, and sexual assault and violence. So that's what that all says underneath that on the name. Let's see. This is a roadmap to what you're going to here tonight. I'm going to talk about an overview of some interim policy changes, some university structural changes that are being contemplated and considered, and a quick look at the new policy template of 6.4, which makes no substantive changes but alters its presentation. Then my colleagues are going to present on the procedures that the working group, so-called working group, has been involved in, and certain proposed revisions under those procedures, and then there'll be time for discussion. Okay, any questions so far about where we've been, where we are, and where we're going? Okay, so this overhaul was prompted by a number of things. The university, in its own deliberations and considerations, felt it was time to review what had been basically in place since 2012. Those of you who were here in 2012 will remember me presenting in another room the change that made that brought the Title IX or sexual assault cases involving students from under the code process to the 6.4 process. And it's amazing to me, students know 6.4 now as something that rings some meaning to them. So that happened back then. Since that time, there's been a number of considerations, how are things working, can this be done better, and there have been legislative changes. You have seen probably guidances from the Office of Civil Rights and a new state law effective October 5th called Enough is Enough, or 129B. 129B, which I mentioned, has just come into effect, mandates for all colleges and universities in New York State certain provisions. These were already in place for the SUNY colleges, and then the governor was able to pass legislation applying it to all of the New York colleges. So, if you take a look at the list there, I don't intend, unless there are questions at the end, to go into it in detail. One of the changes, the affirmative consent, something that you might have heard, yes is yes, changed from the days when things were called no is no. And there's a definition of affirmative consent that is pretty much what we've had anyway. There's a student bill of rights. There's a drug amnesty. That means that someone can report a matter or be involved in the execution or helping to resolve a matter without fear that they're going to be JA, with all due respect to the interim JA in the room, for having a drug or alcohol offense. This is something that's mandated. There's provisions about interim measures, how they're to be handled, transfer. transcript notation when someone is found responsible, what goes on to the transcript, a biennial climate assessment. You've probably all read about the first one that Cornell did with a consortium of other colleges led by the AAU. And finally, some requirements on training and education for students, faculty, and staff. As a result of those changes, Cornell immediately acted, well before October 5th, to modify policy 6.4 to comply with Enough is Enough. So we did add the Student Bill of Rights, the amnesty provision. We updated definitions of those offenses. We put into the JA's office the intake, interim accommodations, and informal resolutions in a formal way through the policy. One of the changes involved my office. I'm the Director of Workforce Policy and Labor Relations, and there are now two full-time Title IX investigators who investigate concerns of sexual assault, stalking, things like that, in our office full-time. They had been doing that out of the JA's office. Now the JA is involved in the earlier aspects, the intake, the interim, informal resolutions, and other things in the process. But the investigative part has been put into our office, where we had always investigated concerns involving faculty and staff. The new feature is that now we investigate sexual assault involving claims made against students. And so actually one of the investigators from the JA's office moved to my office, and we retained a second one. Both have domestic violence prosecution background and are really experienced and well suited to this work. We added appeal of interim measures for Enough is Enough, constructed a new appeals panel. They said that it had to be more than one person, as we had previously had it. We updated the language around confidentiality so that if you look at the policy, you as a potential complainant or respondent, even a witness, will know who you can go to talk to on a completely confidential basis, someone who does not have to report the conversation to a Title IX coordinator, as the vast majority of us have to do. And then we made some changes in the office titles and sort of ministerial changes like that. But there were no other substantive changes. These were all compliant or to reflect institutional changes. Any questions about that aspect so far? Okay. Now, this is really something under construction. As you may have been aware of the fact that Lynette Chappelle Williams is leaving us on November 11th. She has been the top level, now renamed Chief University Title IX Coordinator. And we had worked up, and do have worked up, and are working under a structure like this. We took the original structure that had a chief and a few deputies and converted it into a structure that represented the focus areas of Title IX, women in STEM, pregnant parenting, student support, sexual violence, athletics, prevention, and education. We also incorporated here the WILD structure, the WILD Cornell structure, and have named the position in these various titles, except for two, which have not been filled at this time, denoted by vacant. So with Lynette's departure, the Vice President Mary Opperman, who is responsible for Title IX compliance at the university, is planning to fill that position, the chief, with a new Title IX position that's solely going to do that work. Lynette, as you probably know, has that plus a lot of other responsibilities. She's going to carve that responsibility out of Lynette's old position. And right now, there's an effort to draft the job description, if you will, for that, and hire a chief university Title IX coordinator full-time. I think it's a tremendous move. It does reflect the university's seriousness in this area, and may result in some changes in this. So this is something that's under construction. Don't take this to the bank, but this is the structure as it now looks like. Any And finally, we are engaging in a new policy template. This is the part that I mentioned is not making any substantive changes, but we got feedback along these years that it's too complex or it's too long or it's too hard to find things that people need. So we're going to try to boil this down, and we've made some efforts so far to do so, to a very short and succinct policy part of it, the statement, the reason, the entities affected, like Weill Cornell, Ithaca Campus, et cetera, any entity that would be bound by it, the tech campus, and then hit it with a few principles so that people know basic principles of the policy if they're looking at, hey, did something happen that isn't even covered by this policy or not? Covered conduct, conduct that is not covered by this policy. Importantly, and this is required, as I mentioned, confidentiality rules, rules around retaliation and bad faith complaints, because those are not something that can be ignored by any means. So we have to be very vigilant on claims of retaliation as with bad faith complaints that might be made. And then you have the other two enough concepts. So this is, again, this is very much under construction, but the idea is to have a few provisions of policy principles and then move to the area, okay, what do I do if I'm in the right ballpark? How do I access what I need to know? I've found that it's covered, I've found it's confidential, I've made a decision to move forward, what do I do? So the current thinking on this is to have something like this, using technology, have three maybe sort of offenses listed. Forgive the term, it may not come down to that, but three concerns: discrimination, protected status, sexual harassment, sexual assault, and dating violence, or domestic violence, and stalking, which may not involve any sexual connotation per se. If you find that in whatever final organization of this that we come up with after hearing from you and all the groups, then you click there, and then you describe your status. So I'm a complainant, and I'm a student, and my concern is about another student. Click there, and you put into the procedure for that. You don't have to read about, for example, the procedure if you're complaining about a faculty member, which since 1996, when the sexual harassment policy was written, has provided for things like a faculty co-investigator of a claim. So if you're not in that boat, then you hit the status that is of interest to you, and then that leads you to the procedure. Now, a lot of these will be the same. I'm not trying to say that there's going to be a dozen different procedures, but to get there, to simplify, you click there, and then you know exactly where you're going. So that's the concept. Simple, principle, straightforward, and then right to the zeroing on the procedure. So I think got that. Oh, one other thing, yeah, the timeline. So this is a rough timeline. We had stakeholder sessions we held, as I mentioned before, in the spring. So a lot of these have been developed through hard work over the summer, as indicated. That good faith compliance by October 5th, which we've done, and it's an interim policy. We're doing our stakeholder review at least in October and November. And then finally, there's a certificate of compliance that's due under the New York state law in July of 2016. So we're shooting for all of that and to accomplish a lot in a short period of time. So with that, I'll adjourn and turn it over to John.
Thank you, Mr. Rubin.
We find your...
It should be the power, if you exit out of that PowerPoint, the escape key.
Oh,
it should be the other PowerPoint that's loaded up.
Oh, that looks like it.
And you do a slideshow.
Yeah, slideshow from beginning.
There we are.
Okay, thank you.
So again, thanks for having us. I'm John Tilicano. I'm the Senior Vice Provost for Academic Affairs in the Provost Office. I'm also the Interim Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education. I'm also a former member, or still former member, of the law school faculty, as is my colleague Carol Grumbach. We both escaped a number of years ago, but we're still affiliated. So what we want to do is talk about, so what you've seen is the policy revisions, which are the umbrella. What we're talking about is the real guts of the machinery around the adjudication processes as they involve both pressing and common thing, which is student complaints. And we have spent a lot of time in that. Let me give a little bit of additional context and acknowledge what's really important to say is that by the time you get to adjudication procedures, or in real life, by the time you get to a lawsuit or the, you know, or a criminal prosecution, you're in the last house on the block. It's not a good place to be. What we really need to do in this area is focus a lot of energy, and we haven't talked about it here, but tremendous parallel energy is going into education, prevention, cultural change that avoids getting to this place. But no matter what we do, there'll be cases, as always, in where Cornell has to take responsibility for deciding whether something violated the policy. So as Alan says, and let me just give you a little bit, delve a little bit into some relevant background, is that the current policy 6.4 was adopted in 2012, both in response to federal legislation and guidance some of the problematic dimensions, but also multiple problems of using the campus code to adjudicate issues of sexual assault and sexual misconduct. Campus code is a complicated instrument. It works in other contexts, but it does feature as its main thing trial by combat, essentially very extensive, intense, confrontational type trial processes. It has a number of other features, but it was very clear by that point in time that in the unusual and difficult context of sexual assault, it did not work. It prevented victims from coming forward. It was had the effect of re-traumatizing people who had already suffered trauma in the original assault. And so as a result of these two factors, in 2012, it was removed from the campus code of conduct, although the JA still had an intake rule. And it was switched quite dramatically from a trial kind of hearing context with many full kind of criminal procedure rights of cross-examination to a very the opposite, an investigative model with a single investigator who did all of the fact-finding, reached conclusions as to responsibility and sanctions, and then those no hearing whatsoever, those were reviewed by a panel based solely on paper submission. So it went all the way to the other extreme in terms of what you might imagine as process. And then that would pop up to the Susan Murphy, Susan Acting Service Vice President, for review. We had to revise it based on state legislation recently to include two other senior administrators, that would be me and Mary Offerman, the head of HR. But that's where things stood. At that point, as we made this big change, why are we revisiting it again is a logical question. And it was a result of these things, is that more voices weighed in at the federal and state level. Everyone had an opinion, and they also had a lot more prescriptive measures that we have to comply with. But these are the really important things, independent of federal legislation. There's obviously a growing nationwide concern about the high incidences of sexual assault on university campuses. You probably saw recently the survey that Cornell participated in with many other universities indicating, in fact, very high levels, very concerning levels of sexual assault on all of university campuses. And so that raises the question whether our enforcement policies are sufficient, whether we're doing the right thing. At the same time, so this is arguing in terms of better and more effective enforcement as a means of achieving deterrence and lowering incidents. At the same time, there is a rising national concern that the processes on all campuses, or many campuses, are both not effective and potentially unfair to respondents. So you have victims' rights advocates very concerned, understandably and appropriately, about the point. But then you also have respondent or defendant advocates filing suits all across the country on the ground that the university processes are so anemic in terms of the protection they provide that they are resulting in unfair things. So as a consequence of all of this and our own internal decisions, we've created a number of groups. Carol and I have been part of a Title IX working group that's only looking at adjudication procedures. It also includes Ed Allen from Human Rights Resources, one of the investigators, the interim JA. We've been looking at this. It's a group of lawyers, which is not a good thing by itself. And so what we're trying to do is make sure that we hear a wide variety of voices, including yours. So there's been endless consultations with many constituencies, including detailed interviews with prior review and hearing panel members and chairs to find out what was working and what was not, involved professionals in the field, complainant and respondent advocates. The report that was previously by the All Assemblies Working Group, a very strong guidance from President Gehr, who, as you know, is a former provost and also a law faculty member. And then we spent a lot of time benchmarking our approach and other potential approaches against 18 peer institutions and then a few odd ducks that had interesting approaches. This effort revealed two fundamental concerns that one is the primary thing, and Carol will talk more about this, is the absence of any hearing created a significant problem. One reason is you call it a hearing is stripped out when we moved in 2012 because the campus code of hearing was so brutal and confrontational in this particularly difficult context that it was a deterrent for victims coming forward, and so we pulled the hearing out and just plugged in a single investigator. But the absence of any hearing created other perversities for respondents, you know, defendants, respondents. It so deprived them of basic notions of process where they could actually, in real time, testify in front of a decider that it created questions of fundamental fairness. For complainants, and here's the interesting thing, is that your worry is as you create more process, it's going to discourage complainants because they look like they have to go through a thicket to be heard and get redress. But without enough process, there's this perverse counterintuitive thing, is that if you have too little process, what happens, and we're observing it everywhere across the country, is that the hearing panelists who are only operating on a paper report are so uncertain that there's been a fair review of this that they begin to what's called nullifying the law, is that they don't trust their own judgment, so they either don't find culpability when they really should, but they just aren't, there's been no hearing, or they under-sanction. And those are bad outcomes for victims. You want guilty cases to be found guilty, and you want strong sanctions for this kind of behavior. So for both groups, there was a concern that the lack of any hearing was problematic. There was also the hearing panelists were so upset when they simply got a paper report with no ability to ask any questions of any living being that it caused great uncertainty, confusion, frustration, and ultimately rebellion. And so what you saw is a number of faculties, just including a lot of the law faculty that's very dedicated to helping this work, refused to participate in the system anymore because it was pro forma, it had no real substance. The other big problem is that the procedures were so underspecified that even when you did have hearing, even the panels you did have were constantly suffering from confusion and uncertainty about what they should do. And then this created the risk of the quite inconsistent interpretations and enforcement from case to case because it was just so hard to figure out what to do. Other quick concerns, and then I'm going to turn it over to Carol, who says, will say where we've been. Procedures hard to understand and follow. Respondents were provided advisors through the Judicial Code Counselor, but not complainants. Complainants had victim support, but they didn't have advisors in the process itself. The standards for temporary suspension were unclear. The single investigator was determining that there's all of responsibility and sanction, and then the review panel members left had inadequate training in that show. So I'll turn it over to Carol, but that's how we got to where we were And then she'll sketch out where we are going on the principal point to go down through.
Okay, thank you. So, as we've already told you, the teacher that we're working on is a case just where the student is a responder. And they've been charged with sexual harassment, sexual assault, dating violence, domestic violence, or stalking. This procedure, as with all the others, and Alan showed you that, you know, the one click to get to the relevant procedure, all of them will be easy to access as a standalone section in the policy itself. The procedures are going to provide much more specificity so that the panels are not guessing about things like how do we interpret burden of proof, how to admit certain evidence, et cetera, that sort of thing. And it will be written in a manner that's accessible, assuming an audience of students, so plain English. So as you probably gleaned from the prior slides about what the concerns were that emerged from our in-depth review, we're redefining the investigator's role. So the investigator will still do all the legwork that they're doing currently. They'll do an exhaustive interview of the complainant, the respondent, and the witnesses. They prepare a record. They give it to both parties, the complainant and the respondent, to respond to. And then based on the response, they and the record itself, they prepare a report. Now, under the current procedures, that report includes the findings of credibility and the findings of responsibility and the findings for the sanctions that are just reviewed at by a panel. Under the proposed revision, the investigator would stop short of making any findings. So there would be a thorough investigation. There'd be an assessment of general credibility, but no finding as to responsibility or reputation for finding as to sanction. We've developed a hearing model, but not replicating the hearing as one would know it under the campus code of conduct. And our goal here is to really balance both the rights of due process, rights of the respondents, and the rights and concerns of the complainant, and chiefly for the complainant, that they not be re-traumatized or bullied by inappropriate or aggressive questioning. And also that many of the complainants do not want to have to be in the same room or in the same physical location as the respondent. So we'll have both parties in separate rooms with the opportunity also to participate remotely. Both parties are entitled to testify, and you'll notice we use the verb request witnesses, submit proposed questions and evidence, and view remotely other testimony. And the reason why it's request or submit or propose is because there'll be a hearing chair, and I'll get into that in a minute, who will make the findings as to whether evidence is admissible, questions are appropriate, and ultimately it will be a hearing panel that's asking the questions. So all questions will be indirect. The complainant will never be questioned by the respondent or the respondent's advisor and vice versa. The panel will be 3 members. It currently includes the school only of faculty. We are adding staff. We're making sure that the training is compliant with both New York State and federal law, and it's done on an annual basis. The standard proof will remain what it currently is as preponderance of the evidence. I mentioned that there'll be a hearing chair, and that was a consistent concern that was shared with the name, most particularly by the hearing panel and review panel members and chair, that they didn't have guidance, both because of lack of specificity of the procedures, as we mentioned, but also because they didn't have law training, and people talked about, you know, being really diligent and conscientious, but maybe going an interval of several months between cases, and they felt like they had to refresh themselves constantly on the procedures, and they felt that they weren't, I don't want to say on top of it, but they wouldn't clearly like the guidance of someone's law training. Hence, we are proposing this new role of a law trained chair, that we make sure that the panelists understand and abide by the procedures, standard of proof, evidentiary burdens. This role would be filled by a current Cornell faculty or staff member. They would also serve as a limited gatekeeper, and I mentioned this before, so they would determine in consultation with the panelists and also in consultation with the parties whether certain questions were appropriate, whether certain evidence should be admitted. They would make sure there's compliance with race shield laws and other other requirements, particularly in New York State law about what evidence is and is not admissible. Because of this substantial role as gatekeeper, they would serve as a non-voting member of the panel. And then for some other proposed revisions, we would add now a new role, or guarantee, I should say, of an advisor for the complainant. We currently have the JCCs for the respondent, but not the complainant. And there are two different approaches that we're looking at. One is professional staff member, and the other is, if the law school is able to assist in this way, is developing a course, seminar, perhaps your clinic, where there'd be a faculty supervisor who would educate and work more closely with the students, and creating a JCC-like role to the complainant and continuing the JCC with the, for the respondent. We're going to make sure the temporary suspension standard is better delineated, thinking about you know, balancing the rights in this regard for the complainant and also the respondent, an extraordinary measure, to quote the standard that's in the code right now. We're also adding a possibility, or proposing, I should say, a possibility of alternate resolution, so that after, actually at any stage in the proceeding, if both parties approve and agree, and if the university approves, there'd be an opportunity for alternate resolution that might have a substantial educational component, on any remedial and protective measures that would be necessary. The university would be able to step in if the if there was not compliance with the alternate resolution and go the way of an investigation and hearing. As part of this, though, face-to-face meetings such as mediation would not be permitted. So that is it for the broad overview, and I'll just join my colleagues, and we now will entertain questions, responses.
Thank you very much. I'll open up the floor for questions, but first off, to thank you on behalf of the Assembly. We appreciate your coming here and outlining this for us. I'd also like to appreciate the fact that it appears the your office has stayed true to the, when the University Assembly in 2012 relinquished sexual assault to 6.4, we requested you stay as close to the code as legally possible, and it's, in terms of protections and rights for accused, it seems that you have taken that to heart and following it as closely as possible. We very much appreciate that. In terms of the actual, just a two quick questions on the Assembly. One, when will we have access to a form of a draft policy on which to register comments and to examine as an Assembly? And two, Alan or Mr. Rippon, you mentioned that 6.4 also includes discrimination. That, my knowledge, is that discrimination is still for undergraduates, and graduates still falls under the code, and that only sexual assault, harassment, and et cetera have been moved to 6.4.
Let me take the first and defer to the second, is that this is still a work in progress. It's been a phenomenal amount of work, but we are just beginning, as Alan said, the vetting, the general vetting process. What we wanted to show you is the overall direction and structure, but as Carol said, it has to have a high level of guidance and specificity in it, and we're still working out that, and so what we want to do is get input from the constituent groups, input from the president, have further conversations, and then develop a product. It's in beta version now, but it is not ready for prime time. It may be that when we hear from you in the next question, or from the student assembly or the faculty senate, something that shifts the groundwork significantly. So at this point, we were reluctant to put out what is really purposely an initial version.
Answer the second point is yes, you're right. There's no suggestion at the moment to move anything into a administrative type as amended process other than the sexual assault. And to be clear, that will also include the other elements of stalking, dating violence, and domestic violence.
Yes. Thank you very much. Okay, first off, I have a question for Mr. Thompson.
Just regarding your last point about alternative resolutions to complaints, who will be responsible for putting together these alternative resolutions or presenting them to the complainant and to the respondent? And is there, I guess my concern in asking this question, could there be situations where alternative resolutions are being pressured on a complainant because that's a more convenient way to go?
Absolutely. I mean, I've heard that quite a bit, and we've considered that at length. So in terms of the first part of your question, it is likely that the new Title IX coordinator role would oversee alternate resolutions. So there would be that level of oversight. They would never be proposed to either party. Both parties would have to request it, actually, affirmatively, and agree to it. Now, I understand the concern of pressure. I really do. And in that regard, remember that both parties will have advisors and support persons. You have mentioned that, but that will continue, and they participants throughout the process. Ideally, that support person in the case of the complainant would be very helpful to counteract any pressure. Certainly, the Title IX coordinator should be extremely sensitive to that. On the other hand, I've heard quite a bit that there are complainants who won't go forward at all with a formal complaint, so are getting nothing. And so the hope is, in this compromised fashion, that we won't be pressuring students or other complainants, but that we will be getting remedial and protective measures in place where we would otherwise not have the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hatch.
Yeah. I'm wondering how the complex of issues that you're dealing with of your behavior, when it begins to meld into legal, civil law, or criminal law, and whether, I mean, when we have these discussions as far as revising the code is concerned, and even through the campus code deliberations through the time, you've always talked about the borderline between going down downtown or dealing with it here. And is this a way of, I don't know, I mean, is a part of this conceptualization of standards that where you go beyond it and you're too far? Like domestic violence, I mean, you know, the whole domestic violence discussion going on downtown.
Absolutely.
And why are students any different than that if you have domestic violence?
And it's a very good set of questions, and it's complicated in that some of the conduct here is really just something only a university community would worry about as an internal set of behavior. But then it goes all the way to the other spectrum of domestic violence. This includes domestic violence. It includes rape. And those are also the purview of the criminal justice system. And so the question is, you know, should one system be doing one, and should we just be dealing with the lower end? Lots of complexity around that, but we are legislatively mandated to cover that whole spectrum. And we probably would anyway, because within our community, whatever downtown does, we still have a stake as a community in addressing behavior, even if it's very serious. We're bound by different standards of proof legislatively. So ours is bound by a preponderance, theirs is bound by a beyond a reasonable doubt. So there may be cases where the DA downtown says, look, I can't go for it, I just can't. I'm pretty sure this happened, you know, certainly looks like it to me, but I can't be sure I'd convince the jury, whereas within our community, we would say, and we're legislatively required to use that standard, this is enough to impose a sanction. And they always, one more thing, is they always have the option. We don't have any sequencing, we're not actually allowed to wait until they're done. And they're not allowed, you know, they can act and we can act, but we have to, you know, by legislation address it.
Yeah, and I guess I understand that well, because that's the kind of conversation we would have back 10 years ago when revising the code, or maybe longer. But so that leads me to the second half of my thought question, which was, could deal with these things. And now it seems like there's a third kind of level of monitoring of behaviors. There's the one downtown, there's the code, and then there's this. And it would seem to me like the code deals with theft or with noise or with protest and with a bunch of other things, which can also be legally dealt with. How is it that the code is inadequate? And if it's inadequate, why can't it be made adequate rather than set up a third kind of rail?
So a few answers to that, and Carol and Alan will jump in as well. One is that the code currently has a quite aggressive hearing process. And back in 2012, one of the emphasis there was that you, in the case of sexual assault, because of what it is, you unduly discourage victims from coming forward. If I get punched in the nose, it's a different story than in this context. Given the aggressive hearing process, which might be fine in a punch in the nose case, it has the risk of re-traumatizing victims. So that was one justification. The other is that the code operates on a clear and convincing evidence standard, which legally sits between beyond a reasonable doubt the criminal standard and preponderance of the evidence. But we're mandated in the sexual assault context, and these contexts were mentioned, to have that. So then you'd need to basically encumber the code with
a clause that would say,
in this case, the hearings have to be different and the standard of evidence has to be different. And so in essence, even within the code, you build a different procedure. And so once we've already extracted it out in 2012, our view is let's just keep it separate, so fix it.
But if you don't mind, I'll just follow the final point of the question, and it's all related, these are related. That leads me to wonder about something you said at the very outset of your presentation, which was that there's lots of education and preventative, I use the word preventative services. The code doesn't deal with that. It seems like another component should be built into even this method, which is an adjudicating method of some sort, that really is pushing preventative service and education, as opposed to saying, well, preventative service is somewhere out there, it didn't work, now we've got to take this on. In other words, I guess, I picked up on what you said because that's always been societal change, change of organizational behavior, change of social behavior on the campus. That seems to me to be the most strongest component to making your, not that I want to get you out of the job, I'm sure you want to get out of the job, getting rid of all of the many cases, or at least a good number of the cases.
And
so if you're here, you've got a special community, you act differently.
And that's another reason for alternate resolutions, why it was, and there's been a split on that, but some people said very strongly this is an opportunity to provide remedies of education.
And it's a good question. Partly what you're seeing is just we've broken out this to present to you because it's a major change in the adjudication. Our hope is that in the real world, as all of this work on multiple fronts gets done over the next year, students will experience it as a sort of seamless integration of education about the community, education about drinking, and enforcement mechanisms, so that, the last thing on earth we want them, the world, to see is that this is what Cornell's doing.
Yeah.
This is, like I said, it's the last house on the block. You don't want to get there.
Thank you. And actually, Mr. Ratch, to your second point, the campus code, the reasons it was stripped out, when the assembly removed the sexual misconduct from the code, one of the reasons we wrote in our resolution that we asked that they follow the code, they follow the underlying principles of the code and the new principle, was recognizing that whereas the Cornell community supports the campus code, this is a unique circumstance where there is federal regulation, state regulation, that necessitates a separate policy, but it was the intent of the assembly that the policy is closely, is legally practical, follow the code, and that is what in my estimation they have been doing. Next on the speaker's list is Mr. Kaufman.
Hi, I'm an undergrad graduate. I actually had just one more specific question. So how exactly has the interim suspension process been changed? I know that you said that you're focusing on balancing the right to be accused and the victims, and I think that's great, but I'm just curious, like specifically, what has changed?
My understanding is that the 6.4 policy references back to the code. Is that correct for temporary suspension?
So it's not as explicit as John and Carol and Alan suggested that it needs to be. The standard under code is in extraordinary circumstances and for the purpose of maintaining public order and safety. And my name is Julie Kongchukwuki, and I'm the interim JA and one of the deputy Title IX coordinators. And I helped work on the policy and procedure group.
So there's just a blanket reference back about the specificity in itself in the procedures. So we would have the standards in the procedures and some examples of how this would play out. So instances where there would be extraordinary circumstances such as weapons, repeat acts of violence, but also considerations and examples where you could better calibrate to provide access to an education for the respondent.
So I don't think that there's an effort to change the underlying idea that temporary measures can still have a very severe impact and should be tailored to the circumstances, but the generality of that language creates the potential for variances in outcome that aren't justified. And so this is a classic case where if you all agree on what the standard should be, but if you simply formulate it as a general standard, there's too much potential for just inconsistent application, which is where law typically starts to provide examples. And you don't want to suspend somebody from the university temporarily prior to any hearing unless there's some ongoing ambient risk either to the victim or the community. You really want to lay out what these measures are for as opposed to just acting reflexively. So it's really the same goal, but just more texture.
Thank you. Professor Howard.
The advisors seem to be playing an important role in this, and I appreciate the both parties staff and advisors. One question is, if either party's uncomfortable with the advisors, is there some mechanism for an alternate? And then I guess the related question is, they have the right or ability to bring in outside legal counsel or something.
What we've been looking at in our most recent version, and this, and this is kind of thing that we both have a lot of input on, is that each party would be afforded an advisor by the university, but each party would also be entitled to have their own second advisor, so they provide support and have the opportunity to have two advisors, one provided and one that they select, as well as a separate support person. A lawyer could absolutely fit that role, play the role of the advisor. As there are now under the code, there are limitations, though, on the role that the lawyer could play. So they would not participate. They would be, I think, New York State law uses the phrase advise and assist. So they would advise, but they would not ask questions, they would not be able to argue at meetings or hearings. If there's any problem with the advising that the university provides a conflict of interest, obviously there would be a replacement. But I think the important aspect in terms of your question is that they could also select a second advisor.
Thank you. I know we are running at the end of our time. There's one for a few more questions.
Sure.
Thank you. Professor Love.
Are any punishments specified in any of this new legislation?
No. Actually, no. We just looked at that now. Surprisingly not.
So aside from the temporary suspension, it's sort of wide open in terms of what kind of looks the code. It can go all the way to permanent suspension, to write an essay, community service. Those kinds of things would still be applicable under even the state law that's passed.
Absolutely. The requirements in the state law apply to notifications on the transcript. if you excel, if you do this, if you do that, what the transcript has to say. But they actually don't mandate specific penalties.
And we're as part of this huge effort, we're reaching the point of thinking about sanctions. And it may be that the same need for examples or structure or guidance that is in the temporary measures is something that we would say around sanctions. Because again, you can the spectrum goes from expulsion, which is essentially the academic death penalty, to something much less significant, and then also there's this parallel world of alternate resolutions. So the same issue of guidance is there, but we're getting a lot from the federal and state government and political process. We're not getting much there.
Thank you. And the last question to Mr. Walrath.
How much can you comment on just what are the differences in procedures between students, student staff, and faculty, or other accommodations thereof? Like it's the sort of penalties or suspensions if, for example, a student is in a professor's class, you didn't involve their teaching, how do you involve that ongoing problem or thing like that?
Well, the differences are what you just heard today applies only in the context of sexual assault, sexual violence, and related fields when a claim is made against the student. So that's all you're hearing today. Everything else, that long list of are you with this or that, every other combination or permutation is handled under the existing procedures of 6.4, which is, although there have been some tweaks to that as well, but it's essentially the administrative investigatory process that this began in 2012. It does not involve a panel. It does not involve the indirect right of sort of confrontation. It does not involve any of those procedures, and a lot of differences. So what you heard is just for one specific case.
Thank you. We have exhausted our speakers. This has gone over time. Thank you very much for attending. If anyone else has questions, please forward them along to me. Is there another, what is the way for the Assembly best to provide input and feedback aside from this meeting to the broad
public? Through you, to either it'll come to the same place, Carol, Alan, and I. You can find us. And again, we really welcome it. We're moving towards the more formal version. So this is a great time for us to intersect. And if you have more questions, not only send in your thoughts, but if you have questions, then we can get back to you electronically.
Thank you. Mr. O'Brien, you have a quick comment?
Will the CJC also be reviewing that?
Pardon?
Will the CJC also be reviewing that?
The policy changes will go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's your
time
frame for feedback? Oh, for feedback? the sooner the better, because...
Within a month, it would be helpful.
Thank you very much. Please join me in thanking you for attending. Moving back to our regular agenda, we are moving on to the approval of the minutes from October 6th. Are there any members who have requests for modification? Hearing none, may I have a motion to approve? Is there a second?
Second.
Is there a need to send? Hearing none, we will remove.
I have a question.
Yes,
did
Mr. Brown?
Professor
Oh.
Did you have the question about you didn't want too much detail in these minutes?
I can leave that too.
It seems like there's a lot of detail. Are you still?
Oh, this is minutes?
Yes,
yeah.
We're on approval of minutes.
Yeah.
Mr. Hatch, yeah.
The problem with having a lot of details is that we all have to agree with it accurately and completely captures the details we want. That's the issue. And I felt in particular at that time when I raised the question that the details were there and were not fully and accurately reflected what we had discussed. So if we can decide whether or not it does in this case or not.
So do you want to individually look at that every time, or do you want to just have a creative blanket policy?
Mr. Renner, I believe, and not speaking for the member, that the goal was that the detail I was given was to not adequately summarize the comments that have been made.
So therefore, we have attempted, or speaking with these office and Vishal especially, is a, I believe, a very good job of attempting to capture more detail to provide a more accurate context so that someone does not necessarily have to ruffle through the actual audio to find more detail. Mr. Hatch, do you have a comment?
Actually, it wasn't about that, but it was about the president. I think before I'd be willing to accept the minutes, I think, unless they've done, this has already happened, they should be submitted to the president so that she's aware of her comments being represented correctly.
I can send it along.
And before we, I'm recommending that to the body that we not approve the minutes. We table them until she has a chance to accept what the statement has been in this detail, if you want to put it that way. Otherwise, we just say the president talks to her. But that's, I think it's valuable to have some of her words there if she feels it's valuable. Otherwise, she could say, well, if they would like to know what we feel, then I'd be happy to do it by audio.
Thank you. And actually, if I may, Ms. Jamesy, did you know if, for the UA info, is the president's office included on that listserv?
They're not.
Okay. Well, in that case, then yes, I have no objections to sending along. I may ask you to hold your motion to the table. Mr. Thompson, do you have a brief comment?
Just a comment on your previous point, Mr. McBride. The reason we send out the minutes a few days before the meeting is that each member can review the minutes and make sure that their own and other people's comments are accurately reflected. So if there are any amendments that need to be made, they can be brought up at this time. So I think that's the procedure we should continue to follow.
Mr. Chizo, do you have a comment?
It's more just like a correction on spelling my name, but I don't know if that meant that.
We will we'll speak with the phone handle. So Mr. Hatch, you said you wanted to motion to table this until...
I'll comment on the question of length.
Of course.
I think it's actually not bad to do that if we take our responsibility to look at our comments and send them in beforehand, only because I kind of agree that having something substantive there gives people an idea that there's been a significant, you know, some kind of discussion. But it also has to be correlated with people actually looking at them and saying, I really didn't say that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't know what to do about that. That's my comment on that. But then as far as the tabling, yeah, I wasn't too...
Okay, is there a second? Being that we are motioning to table, I'd ask for actual formal vote. All those in favor of tabling this until our next meeting, please have your placard. All those opposed? And all those would like to abstain. By a vote of 10-0-1, these have been tabled until next meeting. I will forward them along to the President's office to ensure that they have no objections. Moving on to the next order of business, reports from assemblies. First would be the student assembly, noting that Ms. Batista is absent. Do any of the undergraduates have anything they'd like to report on behalf of their assembly?
I would like to say that Matt Indeman has been doing an awesome job with Mental Health Week. We have many, can you talk about that?
It's currently Mental Health Week, Mental Health Awareness Week, which ends on Friday, and the main events left are Dining with Everest Minds with these people in Bardi on Friday from 5 to 7 if anyone wants to come. And tomorrow is the Live Through Spirits Festival on the Art Squad from 1 to 4. And if anyone wants to come again, please do. I think that's about it.
Thank you. Any questions for the undergraduates? Hearing none, Mr. Walrath, Graduate Professional Student Assembly.
So did you get they actually did not meet fall break? This might be the first time that UA has been meeting more often than the but we're now looking to get into our activity setting procedures, starting with our upcoming meeting, and so we'll be tying up most of our time.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Walrath?
That's
Mr. Chairman Tisa.
The joint initiative that the GPSA and the SSA are providing with the former trustees.
So tomorrow night, and we're already down to the wire for some questions, but tomorrow night there is a jointly hosted session with the trustees called an evening with the trustees in Willard Strait Hall from 8 p.m. to 9 p.m., I want to say. In the memorial room, it'll be we'll have representatives from various committees of the Board of Trustees to answer some questions sent in advance by community members, and there'll also be some discussion over what the role of trustees is, to try to clarify that. versus what the role of the administration is, because it seems that there's sometimes confusion as to what the trustees do versus what do administrators do. So.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Waller? Hearing none, employee assembly, Mr. Zizoka.
Nothing changed from last time. We are holding our election for open seats tomorrow. We have five candidates for three positions. There's one non-exempt staff member running for one non-exempt position, and four exempt members running for two exempt positions. For those folks that are not elected, we've also, I've already put in my correspondence to them that we're encouraging them to join some of the UA committees that we have as well. So hopefully we'll get some response from that. And then we're also in the midst of planning our president's trust staff, which will happen November 15th. So.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Sissoko? Hearing none, last and certainly not least, Dean Burns from the back of the Senate.
The Senate did meet last Wednesday, and so we had that. We had the discussion, the whole issue of sexual violence, and the presentation on the AAU survey, just to alert the faculty of its presence. Also, a discussion by Alan Mittman about the movement by the federal and state on various legislative advice. Enough is enough law, and also the OCR saying that any relation between a faculty member and a student would be viewed as non-consensual unless proven otherwise. We also had a presentation for 45 minutes or so from the provost talking about various committees that he has set up that involve large faculty components, and also some about the budget. And then the last announcement is that we do have a faculty forum tomorrow afternoon and evening starting at 4:30 in 700 Clark on financial aid policy.
Thank you. Any questions for Dean Burns? Hearing none, we'll move on to our next part of our agenda, committee updates. We turn to the executive committee, Mr. Thompson.
Okay, so I allotted a few more minutes for the executive committee update because I'd like to bring up some of the comments President Garrett made at our last meeting, particularly those regarding Cornell's goal for carbon neutrality by 2035. This has been a subject of discussion among the executive committee. Just to review, 2013 Cornell's climate action plan was updated to recommend carbon neutrality by 2035, and in December of that year, the Faculty Senate passed a resolution to that effect. And in response, President Gordon in February 2014 accepted the goal to move the university towards carbon neutrality in 2035 and established the Climate Action Acceleration Working Group, which produced a report in June of that year. In May of 2014, the University Assembly passed Resolution 12 urging the university administration to move its goal for carbon neutrality up to 2035 in alignment with the Faculty Senate. And like I said, the Acceleration Working Group report in June outlined some strategies for attaining that goal. And in January of this year, President Gordon again recognized the goal of becoming carbon neutral by 2035. However, just to briefly quote President Garrett from our last meeting, she said, "I've been asked about our goal of carbon neutrality by 2035, and I have to tell you, I don't quite know what that means. There's been no game plan to get there. There's no analysis of the cost to get there. What matters to me is that we are known as the leader in this field of making a difference in the world." And later, "Does that mean we're carbon neutral by 2035? Perhaps. Does it mean it's 2037, 2040? I don't know. To me, that's not the point." So the concern that's been raised, first of all, is that this commitment was made by accepting resolutions passed by shared governance assemblies. And it's concerning that accepted resolutions would be overlooked if they were later found to be inconvenient or burdensome. And we're concerned that the comments reflect that possibly there's been some reneging on the commitment to carbon neutrality by 2035. So I wanted to bring this to the University Assembly members and seek input on how we should move forward on this issue.
Mr. Ash.
These are part of the provision of our action here. The action I wasn't on in 2035 was the an annual report.
That is correct. That was in the beginning of this year, in the introduction PowerPoint, President Skorton, in accepting the resolution 12 from 2 years ago, that's when the Assembly advocated against that effort before 2035. He accepted both recommendations and also said there would be an annual report. Last year, resolution 6, which I served as chair pro tem for, the President Skorton had returned the resolution saying that we were not going to divest, but he also in his response reiterated the commitment to 2035 as well as providing an annual sustainability update to all the assemblies, and it is our intent to follow up with that report as the executive year comes closer to the end.
There was a sustainability summit a while back, and
yes.
Last year, last spring, and with participation by all of the member sectors of the campus, and it seemed to me like there should be a lot more done that engages the president's office and, you know, the policymakers, the administration, in concert with another summit, perhaps, or at least so that these vague statements that undermine the commitment that were made can be clarified and some action can be taken on.
Thank you, Mr. Ratch. Mr. Kaufman.
Yeah, I was going to say I agree that it's concerning, and I would ask when are they due for an annual sustainability update? Is that
it was the resolution states annually, so that would either imply end of academic year or end of calendar year. My goal is to be in contact with the president's office about, I have other matters to address with them, but also to ask if it is their intent to use it annually or academically. Either would be acceptable so long as we do receive a report annually.
Okay, and then the other thing I wanted to say was maybe it would make sense for us to like pass a resolution reminding them that they have a commitment to honor the resolutions that they accept, and that is specifically one that, you know, we have in mind and that we're concerned about. So, just my thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Stratton. Mr. Sissoko?
So, two things. Part of this might just be, as we can see from her staff, and she's a new president, she wants to do things in her own way. So, I think Clara and I agree. Like, you came to our meeting, she's plainly said, I will seek input from others, but at some point I will make a decision that sometimes is not a popular decision, just to paraphrase. So I think it's just working around that. I don't necessarily think it's a punitive thing. It's just she's figuring out what her predecessor left to her. The flip side of that is also, what does the sustainability office have to say? Because they're the ones that are actually involved in putting this out. So do they feel that 2030 or 2035 is still an acceptable goal? I think we've been in meetings where they've been unsure about certain things there too. So have we heard from the office itself as opposed to the president's office?
To clarify, last year when the office or the sustainable office presented the UA, they presented early in the year, and they stated that they had explored 2035. They weren't even sure it was the actual goal. The Assembly actually directly asked President Skorton when he came in the fall what the goal for carbon neutrality was, and he unequivocally stated the goal was 2035, and that was the goal of the university. The reason this is being brought now is because there was, speaking partially on behalf of the exec, there's the concern that it may have just been off the cuff, misunderstanding, but also the concern being that the almost preserving the integrity of past and accepted resolutions in the past is important because, for instance, the UA's ability to be a stakeholder on Policy 6.4 is contingent upon that the resolution, when we ceded that authority, we had a stipulation, we said the all assemblies will be seen as stakeholders under Policy 4.1. The same idea as what we're looking at here is to ensure that the assemblies, when mature governance works and when we have reached a decision, that it is not summarily overturned. By that metric, everything we do is could be swept away at the stroke of a pen with a new president.
And I agree with that. And I think the and part of that is, as a new staff member, let's work with this office to make sure that they understand that, as opposed to against the office.
That is our goal, yes. I agree. Thank you. Next up would be Mr. McBride.
I just had a question about the commitments. Are in any board of, this is probably something that you, Batista, are in any board of trustees governing documents, do they say that when the assembly proposes something, passes something, and the president accepts it, that has to maintain policy? So is there any like legal provisions that she's in violation of, or is it just that we think it should be this way?
That's a good question. I think certainly I would have to
I don't know the governing documents for the Board of Trustees. For the charter for the University Assembly and for all of the assemblies, it's a delegated authority to the assemblies, so they can propose things to the president can approve them, not approve them, or ask for reconsideration. I think to Matthew's statement, the president did approve that. So, but there is nothing binding other than past precedent and what the expectations are of the institution. I think that's the point at hand. But certainly nothing binding. There is no formal legal relationship between the assembly and the president.
Did the Board of Trustees ever approve any of the university charter or SA charter or anything like that, or is that all been through the president's office?
It goes to the office of the president.
Okay. Right.
I believe when the assemblies were created out of the University Senate, the original documents were approved, but upon a day-to-day, for instance, Resolution 2, which modified our charter to update it with the JA search process, that is only going to the President's office.
Okay.
And that's not to say that actions of the assemblies don't rise to the level of the trustees. For instance, R6 and R12 regarding investment, we spoke directly, we worked with the chair of the investment committee as well as our chair Chairman Harrison of the board. So we do interact with them, but on a day-to-day level, they don't generally oversee our governing documents.
I'd be interested in seeing, when the Board of Trustees passed that at the very beginning of the creation of these assemblies, what that said, because that could be binding. So.
Thank you. Professor Howard.
I appreciate you bringing this up. I think it's important to obviously, and I agree that we should try and get the president's attention and get her to buy into the vision again. The reason it came up in our last meeting is that I raised it, and I mentioned later in the meeting my report from the campus planning committee. And at that meeting, just to remind you, the campus architect said that they didn't feel that trying to make the campus carbon neutral was their responsibility and job. The sustainability people also at that meeting, and they did not speak up. But I think there needs to be some strong leadership from the president's office to whom all these people report because it's going to happen. And I think in technical sense, it's correct. Whether it happens in 2035 or 2037 is probably immaterial and hard to predict, but we should have a target to be moving towards it in the campus. And I'd like to see her buy into that and help get direction and funding.
Thank you. Mr. Walrath.
So it seems to me that there's two points at issue here. First being, do our past resolutions hold weight, which I think is very important. So I think there was some discussion at the last leadership breakfast over bringing a joint resolution addressing shared governance in a broad sense. I think it could definitely fit into that in certain ways. The other point on sustainability and whether or not 2035 is actually possible. This isn't the first time we've heard from different people that 2035 might actually just be a political thing that you say. I mean, 2035 is long after most of us here will be gone. Definitely all students. And even in fact, many faculty members will be retiring by then, and many staff will be retiring. point is that it's but to get there, we have to, the process does have to start now. So I wonder if there just needs to be another push to just actually make this some type of firm official policy, and a university policy that states that new buildings must be LEED certified, and a university policy that states that they will continue to seek philanthropy. I think there are more actionable things that can be put into a real policy that the university can write than are existing right now. I mean, just saying, sure, I accept 2035 is great, but you can accept whatever you want. Practically, you could accept 2025, doesn't mean it'll happen without the actual reasons going to, and then 2025 passes and there's no penalty. So I think that there could be another push on asking for more specifics and a specific official university policy that's written, accepted by the president, and codified.
Thank you. Professor Flo.
Just that. As we see, university policy as with federal policy is plastic. You say anything you want. All it takes is the stock market to drop or something else to happen, and it will be 2050. Price of oil drops to nothing. Price shoots up. they're never going to give up, whether it's the trustees or the president's office, the ability to modify what existing policies. When there was Meadline's admission with trying to match Harvard's giveaway to basically fund students so that that worked for about, 2 years before we dropped it because we couldn't afford it. There was a policy, they had to change the policy. Ultimately, the ability to meet this goal is going to depend on nothing but money. And you can say whatever you want, and President Garrett, you know, I mean, she's talked with the faculty as well. And, you know, it's the bottom line is going to be, can we afford to do it? And my impression from hearing her in other venues has been attacking the problems of escalating tuition and cost is going to trump just about anything else. That she, I mean, obviously, you know, let's get more federal money and philanthropy and all of that. Okay, but answering the questions about cost and accountability is something that's going to trump most things.
Thank you. Moving. Is there anyone else who would like to speak who hasn't spoken previously? Hearing none, we'll move on to our second speaker.
I think Professor Howard.
He would be
spoken
right.
Yeah.
Being that we are trying to run short on time, I'd ask that you keep your comments brief. First and second speakers is actually you, Mr. Kaufman.
Oh, I actually cede my time to Professor Howard.
A second one, it's just actually a further. Are you yielding your time, Mr. Professor Howard? You are.
Just a brief response to my colleague, Professor Love. You know, there are things we can do which would not cost the university more. We could move us towards building with less glass and making our buildings more carbon neutral would not cost us more. The campus architect has acknowledged that, but he thinks artistically with that better. So that's leadership and planning. It's not necessarily all about money.
Thank you. Professor Hatch, do you have one more comment?
I don't think we should worry about the money thing right now. We should just worry about saying what we think is important and let it play out. I want to go back to this question of the carbon neutrality and sustainability summit that we had, I think it was last spring, but it may have been even in the fall. Lots of people gathered around the other. I think we need to have a redefinition, and that's why we can have a meeting here with the sustainability folks again and ask them the question about where they stand with it. One thing that came out of the last one was the last meeting we had with them was we put a plan before the trustees to drill geothermal wells, pilot geothermal wells. Nobody's come up with a $3 million. So it is money. But what we have to say is coming up with a $3 million, which is, you know, it's not peanuts, but relative to lots of other things, maybe can be found. Probably can move us along. Let's say that that's important, and then let them think about that. So I think having a seminar here with the sustainability people to talk specifically about this, and then also pursuing the question with the president about putting a report together to get a firm position of some sort about that she says, if she says, for example, lowering tuition or making more available is her priority, let that be on the record, and the sustainability is still something, but it's not the first. Let that be on the record. So I guess I'm suggesting some practical steps that we take, and one of them will be to have another audience with sustainability folks, because we've had an expression that is important to us, and then we go ahead and do that, and we do it fairly soon. And that in that context, we also pursue the letter to the president or the question to the president about when the next report will come.
Thank you, Professor Hatch. In the interest of time, I'm going to move forward. Mr. Thompson, do you have any further updates?
No further updates.
Thank you. Moving on, the Campus Infrastructure Committee. Professor Lowe.
We are still not fully staffed. We're still missing 4 people. I went ahead and said we couldn't wait any longer. We'll go with what we have, and was unable to get a meeting time.
Okay.
So I'm still need people.
Did you hear from the employee somewhere? There is someone interested. So.
Is there anything the executive and I can do to support you in terms of nailing down time or any support? Please don't hesitate to let
them
know.
Been working with Marty.
Right. Okay. In terms of staffing, Marty is the correct one.
Right.
In terms of just if you're having trouble getting rooms or something else on the large level.
That said, the rooms, if it's finding the time,
Joe Lee. Yeah. And I've talked, there's two faculty and two physicians on both campus infrastructure and campus welfare, as well as one faculty and faculty. I guess that's the work.
Well, Mike's committee hasn't met yet, and he's been in New York on the seminar this week, and he was in Philadelphia last week on the seminar.
So we're working on that, and then I've talked with, if the employee assembly has found somebody, that's great,
yeah.
Send it to us. And I think PCSA also has a couple of positions. You know, you go through now the case and it's going. I think I approached PCSA about that.
Thank you. Any questions for Professor Lowe? Hearing none, moving to the Campus Welfare Committee. Mr. Smith sends his regrets. He could not be here. Giving his report will be Mr. Indemini.
So we'll be meeting with the ADA coordinator team on Thursday to discuss two resolutions. One is the UA, one is the UA resolution, and one is an asset resolution. And we'll be bringing forward two resolutions, one on disability and one on restroom usage policy. And the next meeting is on the 28th.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Indemini? Hearing none, moving on to the Codes and Judicial Committee, noting that Mr. Mezzi is not present, are there any members of the committee awaiting the report?
Yes.
We had an initial meeting about the judicial administrator, I'm doing this in the context of the Codes and Judicial. The search committee met today, and things are proceeding nicely.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hatch. Mr. Coffin, did you just mention the CJC?
Yeah, so the CJC still hasn't met, so that's about it.
Thank you, Mr. Coffin.
Pretty much sums it up.
Just an administrative note, the CJC is all but almost fully staffed. I believe we have one employee who is remaining, one vacancy for the CJC. We will be in contact with, or I will be in contact with the various committee heads or committee chairs to make sure we move forward. Mr. Walker, I have a question.
Not dragging too much time for this. Is there an official policy or anything that states that committees must wait to be fully staffed before they can start?
There is none. We, at last meeting, and speaking with the chairs unofficially, we had hoped, or actually I had stated, that we're at the point where we must move forward, and Professor Lowe is doing that. The CWC is meeting already. Mr. Mezzi, I spoke with him also, and he said they will start meeting regardless of staffing. Obviously, our goal is to ensure they are eventually fully staffed, but we are at the point where the committees are moving. It's just a matter of nailing down times so the committees may meet.
Okay.
Any further questions? Hearing none, moving into our liaison updates. First up is CSBP liaison. Ms. Perlman is not present. Moving on, the policy advisor group, Mr. Kaufman.
Hi, so I actually, they have sent an email out, and I have been officially added to the listserv, and I'm looking forward to the monthly meetings that I'll be having as the UA liaison to the policy advisory group. Again, if you guys have any recommendations with respect to specific policies, just let me know so I can relay that information to the group.
That's a question. The University Assembly has a unique relationship with the policy leaders and policies. You have the policy on policy. Things have to come here. They revamped their website, and so there's no way to actually find that policy to reference it. I've been in contact with that office. They acknowledge that their search function doesn't point to the right place right now. I guess they're working on that. But I would ask you to sort of keep that up so that we, at least this body and my office, the Office of Assembly, know where to find that policy. It's a very important one.
Are you referring to 4.1?
That's the policy on policy.
Yeah, actually, I think it is on their website.
It is on their website. You can't find it on their website. You have to be given
the
URL.
Okay, yeah, I'll get the URL out.
Again, for this body, but also make sure that it's anybody who wants
right,
to find
right,
it.
Right, right, right. I'll that's a good idea. I'll probably make an announcement.
Thank you. Further questions for Mr. Kaufman? Hearing none, moving on to the Student Health Fee Advisory Committee liaison, Mr. Indemini. Health Fee is, sorry, Mr. Thompson.
The SHFAC still has not convened, but I believe Dr. Korsen-Reichert is aware that there are members now, so meetings are forthcoming.
Thank you. Any questions? Hearing none, Mr. Indemini for the Student Insurance Advisory Committee.
We're meeting tomorrow morning, actually.
Fantastic. Is this the first meeting of the year?
There was another one, but nothing was accomplished. attempt setting date.
Organization is important. Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Indemani? Hearing none, we have exhausted our agenda. Is there any further questions, comments, or concerns to be brought forward? Hearing Mr. McBride.
Did we get those PowerPoints?
I can comment on that, and it has to do with the question of minutes. I asked for the PowerPoint, and they suggested that they didn't want to release them yet because they don't want to have them broadly circulated until they've got a little farther in formulation. And that leads us to the question of minutes and thoroughness of it. And it makes me wonder if we have visitors and guests, whether or not it should routinely, our minutes should routinely go to the visitors and guests to make comments on them, so that when they come to us, like the president, we can say, and they've been vetted by the people who did the presentation. It's not a censorship question at all. In the case of these minutes, it's simply a matter that they're not, at least the PowerPoint, they felt that they weren't far enough along that they wanted just part of the information to get there.
Thank you, Mr. Hatch. And I, moving forward in terms of, form, I would have no problem sending minutes out in advance to those who had attended the meeting in an effort to have them correct if it's perceived an error. Obviously, the Assembly is free to weigh any corrections or suggestions with the audio as well as their own recollection, but I have no reason to not do that, and we'll be happy to do so going forward. In terms of PowerPoints, we have them. I mean, they're sitting on that computer right there. So if we would like, I would be able to send them to the members under an idea of confidentiality and the hope and the expectation that they not go external. That being said, we'll discuss that after meeting with you, exec. Mr. Coffin, do you have a comment?
Yeah, actually, so I don't think that it should be confidential. I mean, these are public meetings. I think that these are, like, I'm part of the Policy 6.4 working group, and, you know, one of my responsibilities is to talk to students and solicit feedback about this. So if this is what they're thinking, I actually would really like it if I could, have some of these notes so that I can talk to some of my constituents about what they think of these changes. So I don't know if there's anything we can do about
this
that.
This is a very important point. Thank you very much for the comment in response. That's why I was asking that.
Yeah.
I would suggest that it's important enough that it be pursued with them by yourself or any other member of the Assembly. But I suggest that we shouldn't release them until you've been satisfied in your office, or you haven't been one way or the other. But I agree with you. It's a public meeting, and we should have more discussion in that particular issue.
Mr. O'Brien, have you further comment?
I thought they said they didn't want to release the written text of their new proposal, but did they say they wouldn't release the PowerPoint?
Oh, I asked specifically.
Yeah, okay. Can we at least see the PowerPoint, though? Because just I want to think about it more.
Well, and that was my point. I have, you know, we actually have a copy of the PowerPoint. I would be able to send it. I will send up all of you requesting it, the ability to publish them broadly to the info listserv. Mm-hmm. However, the members listserv traditionally is a closed listserv, and I personally would be comfortable sending them out to the members with a note expecting that until we have broader clearance that they are only for internal consumption, considering the fact that as members of the Assembly, you are entitled to all information brought before the Assembly. And it would be no different than if you were writing the notes yourself.
Well, maybe I shouldn't have put myself on the spot by asking them, but I don't want to be in a position of your passing them out to the Assembly members. That's specifically what I asked them before somebody talks to them specifically, like yourself.
I will I appreciate the concern. I will speak to them. I'll send an email tonight. Hoping I hear back from them shortly, we will take their wishes into consideration. That being said, the members of the Assembly, this is a public forum, a public meeting, and the minutes, everything is public. But I appreciate it. Any further comments, concerns? Hearing none, it is 5:59. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.